9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Welcome to the WSJ Media Mix Podcast, bringing you interviews and analysis with people that matter in the fast-changing media business.
Hello and welcome to the WSJ Media Mix Podcast. I'm Amol Sharma, media editor here at The Journal, joined by our intrepid digital media and advertising reporter, Mike Shields.
How's it going, Amol?
What's up? And we're thrilled to have with us today Jeremy Liu of Lightspeed Venture Partners. He's a guy with an interesting take on a lot of happenings in media, usually when we talk, and so I'm excited to have him on. He's a specialist in consumer-facing media investing. He's an investor in Snapchat, the first, I believe, right, Jeremy?
That's right.
We'll get into that a little later. And he's also a backer of a lot of other digital media outfits you've probably heard of, Mike, Cheddar among them, Little Things is another one. So we're going to get into some of the big issues in the industry around digital media and investing, and glad to have him on. Jeremy, let's start with just the broad broad feeling about ad-supported media right now, which is sort of bleak. And we've had, recently, you know, people talking. Ev Williams from Medium write this blog post that rocketed around that was sort of talking about the system being fundamentally broken and, you know, he has to go search for a new model. And it was a sort of a dark view, and not everyone agrees with it. We talk to other people who say, you know, you're just not doing it right. Who's right on that point?
Well, thanks for having me. I think historically people have thought about building media businesses in terms of CPM, you know, the revenue that you can get from advertising times number of impressions that you have. And, you know, given that we're living in a world of permanent oversupply of inventory, in a lot of those instances, you see relatively low revenue per 1,000 impressions. And so you do this math that says that you need to be enormous to ever make money at any reasonable scale. And I think that's not necessarily the best way to think about these media businesses going forward. Because in this environment where you've got a permanent oversupply of inventory, I think a better way to think about the business is the number of insertion orders that you have for advertisers, and then the average insertion order size. And if you think about the business that way, then really the only way you can get the business to scale is through getting the average IO size up into six figures and beyond. And that requires you to be either enormous in scale, which is still the same as before, or alternatively, if you want to become a brand advertiser, or if you want to appeal to brand advertisers, you need to somehow become part of popular culture and become a must-buy because of your content and the adjacencies that provides to advertisers. And that's something that I think is a new way of thinking about how you build these media businesses. Vice is a fantastic example of a business that got to amazing scale by being able to drive its average order size up well in advance of actually building the scale of traffic. And I think we're seeing other companies do the same thing. But
perception of their traffic is actually much higher than it is, partly because of perhaps what you're saying. It's the penetration of popular culture that they've managed to do.
It is that penetration of popular culture, and in particular, penetration of popular culture amongst the people who make advertising buying decisions.
Right. So is that some of the outlets that you back, and there are other small and medium-sized publishers who've talked about being more focused, whether it's on native or making custom ad formats that aren't, you know, the standard banners and are outside the strictures of the traditional display ad world. Are those people going to be any better off in this environment just by focusing on the mechanics of the kind of advertising you serve? Or is it really just a matter of, as you point out, if your content is reaching that threshold of popular culture, you'll be fine. It doesn't really matter. You'll get those big ad deals. Or does the type of advertising and the kind of plumbing of it matter as much as a lot of people seem to say right now, which is kind of the general discussion?
I think that the tactics aren't enough. You know, it's not about what the ad unit is and whether it's native or not native, or whether it's programmatically buyable or non-programmatically buyable. Once you become part of popular culture and you're getting the inbound calls and you're a little bit of a must-buy, then that allows you to build new units which are not commodity units. And that's what allows you to then start to drive your average order sizes up, because you're providing value in a way that is not easily substitutable by someone else. And, you know, if you think about kind of how a lot of these media buys end up happening, there's a spreadsheet that a media buyer is looking at. And each line item on that spreadsheet is substitutable with something else. But if you are, let's say, Twitter doing a sponsored tweet, or if you're Facebook with a unit that no one else sells, then you're not substitutable by anybody else. And so the real value is when you become your own line item on that spreadsheet, and that comes again from being part of popular culture.
So you really don't want to be part of the middle. Like you don't want to be the sixth best sports site or the fifth best news site, because you're just not going to be on those buys.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, you know, by definition, there's 10 sites in the top 10. There can never be more, and there can never be less, and there's scarcity in that. And yet there's 250 sites in the top 250, and there's no scarcity in being one of the top 250 sites for anything.
Do investors have more leverage now in new media and digital publishing, I guess, broadly speaking, than they did 2 years ago when people are coming up for follow-on rounds of funding? I know this is a bit tricky. Let's take your guys off the table. I'm just talking generally as an investor. There's evidence of something changing. You know, BuzzFeed's recent round was basically flat with Comcast. You hear of other investors talking about putting ratchets in there and other types of, for people listening, just other types of terms into their deals that are advantageous to the investor, liquidity preference or whatever. It seems like something has changed. The calculations have changed. Is that accurate? Has the playing field shifted a little bit from a couple of years ago in this area?
I think that you've seen that across technology broadly. Mm-hmm. I don't think that applies in any particular way to media companies. And I think it's in large part a reaction to just supply and demand. If you looked at the number of investments and the size of venture capital into companies in, say, 2015 or 2016, 2016 is down on 2015, and it's particularly down in those later stage investments. So if you look back at the historical high points in 14 and 15, you saw a lot of new investors coming into the later stage investing market, people that have historically not been investing in venture-backed companies, public market crossover investors, sovereign wealth funds, large family offices, insurance companies, and so forth. And as you saw that increased demand for these companies across the board, you saw prices go up. As some of those people have since left the market, with lower demand, I think you're seeing a readjustment of pricing. And in some cases, some of the companies that might have been a little bit overpriced in the past are getting reset.
Little reset of the it's just that those types of adjustments happen all the time, I guess, in different areas of business. But your point of the supply and demand there, that's interesting. I guess that's what we're seeing play out. I wanted to ask you, Facebook in particular, which has been obviously a huge driver of growth for all of these media outfits in the last few years. The big question had been around video monetization and sort of in the last 18 months, people looking to see what they would decide to do. Of course, the one of the big developments is the mid-roll video ad, the ad inserted in the middle of a video. What are your feelings on that? Is that going to be a good solution? Are enough people going to get to the middle of enough videos for that to make enough money for everyone, I guess is the question.
You know, TV budgets have been moving pretty slowly into other channels, even as video consumption has moved from TV to online and mobile. And part of the reason for that is that there hasn't been comparable inventory to a television 30-second spot. I think what Facebook's move is going to do is to really increase the amount of inventory available that is highly comparable to a television spot that a brand advertiser knows how to buy. And once you give them the ability to buy that scalably, and deliver broad reach, which Facebook is able to do given its 1.1 billion daily active users. I think that this is going to be a fantastic move for the industry. It's going to start to really pull a lot of this revenue, this advertising dollars that have been sticking in television because there's been no good alternative, finally into the digital video.
Do you think this will be a tipping point where with the TV, the big TV negotiations happen in the spring, Mike will be schlepping around to about 50 ad presentations at the upfronts, they're called. So you think this is because of this, it'll be easier for the big media buyers to see inventory they're familiar with that's similar and move bigger budgets this time? I mean, every year we kind of say it's going to happen, never really happens.
You know, I think industries move en masse. You know, Facebook's move is important, but it's also important in the context of Snapchat, putting together more video advertising, and more advertising inventory between stories. It's also important in the context of YouTube continuing to create more video inventory and making that more available. And then in this new generation of, as you see BuzzFeed and Tasty and Tastemade and Mike and Little Things, all creating more video inventory that looks a lot like TV. Again, this stuff all moves together, and that's what allows the dollars to start to flow.
Do you think Facebook needs to do something to change its consumption patterns to make it a little bit more like television? I guess the challenge you hear from the people that still believe in television advertising is, yes, the audience is humongous, but the session lengths are not like television. It's very fleeting the way people flip through Facebook feeds. They don't sit there and watch a video for an hour, half hour. They don't accumulate the audience. It's the same way that television does. Do they need to address that somehow?
I don't think that watching video on Facebook or watching video on Twitter or in these new channels is going to be an exact one-for-one match for television. But if you ask yourself, are you reaching an audience of millions or tens of millions of people with a piece of video creative advertising at scale, and can you deliver day and date, for instance, so that when you're launching a product, can you deliver that reach all at the same time? You start to see how there are enough analogies that I think that some of those dollars will start to flow.
Was the live thing more of a passing trend for professional publishers, or do you think that's a real thing that's going to continue to grow? Because in the last few weeks, we've been reading stories about, well, maybe Facebook will more want to license more premium content, and they don't want just people setting up and doing something live for the heck of it. They want real premium stuff. And that might be partly because of they know what's going to attract the ad dollars. But is there experimentation going on? Just your theory on what all this is, because there's been a lot of different strategies in the past, from content, what kind of content to put on there.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of dimensions to think about that. One is that for Facebook in particular, Facebook made live a priority. And when Facebook makes live a priority, that has an impact on the ecosystem.
Everyone does Facebook. It. Like, everyone jumps.
They said, listen, right. We're going to put our thumb on the scale for people who do live. And everyone said, well, maybe we should do more live.
Right.
And when they decide to take their thumb off the scale, then people will do less of that. Because that's a system where they signal what they want and people deliver on it. And at the end of the day, Facebook is optimizing for engagement. They have some hypotheses. They had a hypothesis that live was going to work. It seems like they ran that experiment. Now they're running some other experiments. And whatever it is that they are going to advantage, other people are going to create more of, because that's just the way the alignment is. Now, there's another question which isn't specifically about Facebook and isn't specifically about live, but around this idea of ambient video or ambient television, which historically has been what you get on TV. So you've got appointment TV, which demands your full attention. If you're watching House of Cards or Game of Thrones, that is the equivalent of what you get from VOD today from Netflix or Amazon Prime or something like that. And that's a big part of what people are watching TV for today. But then there's also this other big chunk of ambient TV that is it's almost company. It's what you've got on when you're getting the kids ready for school in the morning, like the Today Show or Good Morning America. It might be what you're doing while you're getting some things done around the house, The View, Doctors, just about anything in daytime. or even when you're unwinding after work and, you know, you've got the Daily Show on or any of the late night shows, partial attention, typically live, not always, but often, or live to tape. CNN, unless something newsworthy just happened. ESPN, most of the time, unless there's a big game. That ambient entertainment doesn't exist in this new TVOS operating system. There is no equivalent of that for Facebook or Twitter, because if you're watching on a small screen, there's no way you can do something else while looking at that screen. And if you look for, you know, the equivalent of news on you know, on a Netflix, like it just there is no timely news on Netflix. And so I think what we're going to see is that, whether it be live or not, that sort of ambient TV starting to appear across all these TV OS players, because that use case isn't going to go away. And as more and more people are cord cutters and cord nevers, and they rely on a Netflix or an Amazon Prime as their only video in the house, not as a supplement to TV, that use case is still going to exist.
Great. Well, we're going to take a quick break and be back with more of Jeremy Liu on the WSJ Media Mix podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
I'm Veronica Dagger, and I want to retire rich. How about you? Then listen to the Watching Your Wealth podcast. We'll help you get there. For more information, check us out at WSJ.com/podcast and find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
So, Jeremy, on that point about ambient TV, you're one of the only, I think you might be the only person who's really framed it this way, which is why I find it so fascinating. The idea that, you know, we've been told for the last, I don't know, the entire time I've been covering media, that everything is going to be on demand. So you've heard, like, Time Warner's Jeff Bukas say this over and over again on earnings calls and things like that. But you're fundamentally saying that's leaving out a certain behavior that actually people will want, even if they don't know they want, which is have something on. Was that one of the reasons that Cheddar was interesting? That's the business focused news channel for youth focused. That's an online network that you've invested in. Was that part of the thinking there? Is that one of those ambient, you're going to have a news channel on, I guess, even if you're a cord cutter?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's informed a number of our investments, and you know, and certainly it informed our Cheddar investment. It also helped that Cheddar was started by John Steinberg, who was president of BuzzFeed, who's an extraordinary entrepreneur and executive, and certainly someone who knows the media business.
The broader thesis that you have on OTT and what's going to happen to the future of television, we've talked about before, and I'd love to hear you lay it out a bit here. But how do you see the next year and a half or two playing out in terms of the pace of cord cutting and the behavior of those people? How quick, what will they be signing up for these skinny bundles that are all hitting the market? You know, the Hulu one's coming out soon at a pretty aggressive price point. You've got AT&T and DirecTV Now out there. Do you see a tipping point there as well, with that beginning to accelerate? That's been slow and picking up pace, but not really a fast pace of cord cutting yet. And I think people are wondering, 2017, 2018, what's your outlook?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure of the timing, but I think that direction is right. And if you think about, you know, we've been seeing data that says that people are moving their video consumption from television to online and mobile for more than 10 years now. I mean, YouTube was bought in 2006. And yet every year cable households goes up and goes up and goes up, or at least remains steady. And 2016 was the first year that we saw cable households down. And so the question is, like, why now? Like, what took so long?
Yeah, what did take so long?
You know, I think it's because if you were 14 years old in 2006 and you grew up watching YouTube, you're 24 years old now, you're graduating from college and you're forming your own household, and since you never developed a television habit, you're a cable never. You don't sign up for cable from the beginning.
And the options are a lot better, right? There wasn't a Hulu. There weren't as many cord cutter subscription options out there that you can take control of your media habits a little bit more.
I think that's exactly right. But you know what's interesting though is that historically, all of those skinny bundles, whether it be a Hulu or a Netflix or whatever, not even skinny bundle, all these TVOS options, they've always been a supplement to TV because TV has been there in the household. Now that it's a substitute for TV, that's why you have to ask yourself, well, is it covering all of the use cases that TV currently covers? And the answer is clearly yes to appointment TV, and the answer looks largely to be no for this ambient TV use case. And so the question is, at what point do these new TVOS players decide they need to actually wrap that in as well to reduce the churn from people who are thinking that they are going to be fine with that and then realizing they actually want to add another skinny bundle or in fact go back to cable because they're missing this piece?
Yeah, and what's fascinating to me from the flip side of it, from the media, from the content companies, the TV channel people, is how resilient, I guess is the word, those businesses are. I mean, it's basically the equivalent of nuclear war is happening around media right now, and these and little channels are surviving through it, and they're getting renewed carriage deals with big cable companies, and it seems like there would be no logic to it. People are shaving their bills, and those networks are losing their distribution in America and becoming having smaller reach, but it's so they take. Some of these little channels over the last 20 years have taken, you know, they take so little to run. You put reruns on there. They don't invest a lot of programming at a lot of these small networks. And then they collect monthly fees, and it's, you know, they do like 70% margins. And it's a very hard business to turn off. It takes so many people cutting and shaving the cord before the big media companies start cutting down a lot of networks in the bundle. That's why I have thought this is going to go on for a few years. It's going to take a lot to kill that business. That's yesterday the Esquire network at NBC Universal one said it was going to shut down and go digital, but you know, the question is when that gets to the Bravo and to the E, and then right, that's sort of the next question, and that's what everyone I talk to is all wondering when that will happen, because that's not happening right now.
I think what's interesting is, like, you know, everything is more resilient and takes longer and it's harder to kill than you think.
Right.
You know, Facebook became massive, and yet AOL and Yahoo still exist. Now, they are not as big as they used to be, but they still exist. And so I think you're going to see something similar. You're going to see this new generation of kind of video content company. I don't want to call them cable channels because they're actually going to be consumed in a different way. And they're going to start getting more and more distribution from these new MSOs, these TVOS players. And yet the old guys aren't going to die for quite a long time. Because if you think about, you know, new audience, new medium, new channel, it's hard to use the same programming. I mean, you think about a CNN, average age of a CNN viewer is, I think, like 58 or something like that. The average age of a Fox News viewer is 73. That the way you program for those audiences is going to be different than the way you program for a mid-30s audience of Netflix viewers or Amazon Prime viewers or Hulu viewers or Twitter TV viewers or Facebook TV viewers. So, you know, it seems reasonable to believe that the CNN of Facebook will not be CNN.
You talked about Snapchat providing a form of entertainment for this newer generation. Do they need to justify their upcoming IPO, they seem to want to follow Facebook's path, but Facebook had a clear breakout moment at some point when they went beyond college age. It was restricted to college students and then opened up to the broader market, and all of a sudden you had multi-generations on there. Snapchat, they'll talk about how they're growing above 35 demographic, but I don't know if you've seen that breakout yet. Do they need that to happen?
I think that Facebook's an extraordinary company, and the companies can be incredibly successful without reaching 1.1 billion daily active users. So, you know, Snapchat is growing its user base, and it is definitely aging up faster than the users are getting older. So it is broadening its reach amongst different demographics, but to say, well, it hasn't done it as quickly as Facebook, I think sort of is an unreasonable expectation.
It's not fair to compare anybody to Facebook.
Exactly.
It's there's nothing else like it in the world, but it's something that's actually hindered Twitter over time, right? They keep getting that unfair comparison that they can never seem to live up to.
Did you before we go any further on Snapchat? Can you briefly tell people the story of how your investment came about? Just because it's kind of fun. I mean the way it was.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we were very lucky. My partner's daughter was at high school at the time, and it was a high school where Snapchat was popular relatively early. And my partner Barry Eggers. Is a involved enough dad that he noticed that his daughter was using this new app like all the time. And so he asked her about it. And she told him, yeah, it's this new app, Snapchat. This was in 2012. And she said, there's three apps that everybody has at school, Instagram, Angry Birds, and Snapchat. So, yeah, as you can tell, this was 2012. Right? and so we'd heard of the first two, but we hadn't heard of the third. So, you know, he mentioned it to me, and then I looked into it, but you know, when you download Snapchat, in the absence of having friends on it, it's actually hard to kind of get the point. So I didn't really understand it. At the time, the Snapchat www.snapchat.com just had an info@snapchat email address. So I emailed it, interested in learning more, and I never heard back. And then the next week, you know, Barry asked me, hey, did you ever find out more about Snapchat? And I said, well, I'm working on that. So I looked up Snapchat on LinkedIn, and there was no listings of anybody working for Snapchat. I did a Whois lookup to find out who had registered the URL.
Some serious sleuthing here.
Amazingly, this isn't that long ago.
Really. It's not. It was March of 2012. At the time, I didn't know this then, but they had maybe, you know, a few tens of thousands of users. And I found info@Tapoya Group had registered the Snapchat URL, so I emailed that, and I didn't get any response. So I looked up Tapoya Group on LinkedIn, and I found that there was one employee of Tapoya Group. It was this guy, Evan Spiegel, who was the CEO of Tapoya Group and a sophomore at Stanford. So I tried messaging him through LinkedIn, and I never heard back.
Don't worry, the same has happened to Mike.
Yes.
So by this point, it had become a challenge. So I just tried blindly emailing different, you know, Spiegel_Evan@ToyaGroup.com.
You're hired as a reporter at the Wall Street Journal.
Very similar to our tactics.
And I never heard back.
Well, I assume he's too young to use email, probably.
Well, that was the thing. Is like my last resort is I tried messaging him on Facebook, and I got a response in like 5 minutes.
Funny.
He was at Stanford. My office on Sand Hill Road is, you know, a 5-10 minute drive away. He came over. We cracked open his, you know, analytics dashboard. He showed me how the company was growing and they engaged, and the users were incredibly engaged. They were coming back multiple times a day, multiple days a week, and they were sticking around and continuing to use the product. And he explained, you know, why. And this idea is, I think, obvious today, but at the time it was not obvious, which is that there was this increasing performance anxiety around, you know, living your life in public on Facebook or on Instagram that was causing people to only show the highlight reels of their lives on those platforms. And he said, you don't build relationships with people if you can only see the top 15% of their life. You got to see them not just when they're excited and proud and happy, but when they're feeling goofy or silly or sad or angry or... You know, all 360 degrees of a person is how you build a relationship with somebody. And now that people were principally communicating digitally, they weren't getting that out of these other platforms, but they were getting it from Snapchat. And that was an incredible insight. So he understood why it was working. It was clearly working, and it was working to the level that he couldn't pay his server bills. And I said, well, maybe we can help you with that. And within a couple of weeks, we signed a term sheet to lead his first round of investment. And it's been an amazing rocket ride.
The rest is history. Well, and we'll wrap it up here. But the now we're, of course, we're at the point where they're preparing to go public. I realize you're limited on what you can talk about there. But broadly speaking, when you think about the evolution of that company, there are a lot of different cases they could take to investors, public investors, about what they are and how to position themselves in the tech world and media world. they could sort of say, you know, we're the next big mobile growth story like Facebook. You remember, you know, there was a not a great IPO mechanically there, but then of course it took off and is a great story now. So you could do the mobile growth story. You could say we're going to be the ones to capture the TV ad dollars for real. You can talk about, we are the anti-Google, anti-Facebook kind of other party that you can go put your digital ad dollars if you feel like they're eating everything up. But so of those options, what makes the most sense, or is it some combination of that?
Yeah, I can't really comment on that given the circumstances. But I think, you know, soon enough we'll get a chance to hear it directly.
Okay.
Have there been any more secret entrepreneurs you've met recently, like Evan, that are coming? You can tell us
about
now.
Yeah, just tell us, yeah.
Well, you know, I'm excited about a lot of stuff. I'm really excited about Giphy. That's been just incredible in riding the explosive growth in messaging. And they talk about post-literate communication and how you can capture emotion and feeling and relationships between people into a text-based medium. I think that's a company that, you know, sees 100 million people using Giphy, whether through Facebook or through Twitter or directly on the website, every single day. And what's interesting about it is GIFs are the first innovation in messaging that has started in the West. Everything else has started somewhere in Asia, whether it be emojis or stickers or digital goods or even the fact that you're messaging at all on a mobile device. It all started in Asia. But GIFs is starting in the West and then spreading back to Asia. And so that's a really interesting phenomenon.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much, Jeremy. This was great.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on the WSJ Media Mix podcast.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.